From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a downstairs conference room in a Rochester company. No one was forced to attend this particular event, but dozens of people did. Some were eager to do so. Others were admittedly scared. They thought they should be there. It was a conversation about race, and it happened here at WXXI. This was a few months ago, and there were tears in that room. Colleagues from all racial backgrounds shared stories that they've never told publicly. It was powerful, sometimes painful. It was important. And we asked the organizer of that event to join us here on Connections. Jackie Campbell is the director of Rock the Future at the Children's Agenda. In this case, her work has taken the form of something known as Table 23. We'll talk about what that means in a moment. And in some ways, we want to hear how Jackie facilitates these conversations, what questions she asks, and what questions she wants us to ask about ourselves. And it seems these discussions are now more urgent in our community. So she's back here. It's great to see you. Jackie Campbell, welcome back to Connections. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Alan Ziegler, who is the founder and president of the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation and a member of Table 23. Alan, welcome. Thanks for being
here. Thanks, Evan. Glad to be here.
And Heidi Zimmermeyer, also a member of Table 23 and the president of the Rochester Downtown Development Corporation. Welcome back to you.
Thanks.
Table 23 is what? This is going back 6 years, you were saying, Jackie?
Yes.
I don't think I knew it was that long. So what happened?
We didn't know it was that long either until we started to add up the time. We began as a group at FREE, which was Facing Race, Embracing Equity. And we started on the launch date, and Alan has better details about what the actual date. But we were participants in a conversation, and we sat at table 23. And when everybody broke and went for lunch or something, we stayed and we kept talking. And at the end of the day, and it was a day long, right?
Right.
At the end of the day, we decided that we wanted to continue to meet and talk, and we launched table 23.
And you've been doing it now for 6 years, and some of the conversations that have come out of that, I mean, I'm inferring that when you were here at WXXI, you know, you're using some of those sort of conversations, some of those ideas, some of those questions, you're bringing them to companies like ours, and you're asking us to ask questions of ourselves. I mean, do you have a sort of a model now of how you approach that those kinds of conversations?
Absolutely not. So I don't want to give the impression that I'm running around to different places and actually doing this. I was actually asked the organizer of that event, were a few people here at WXXI, which included Joanne Gordon, and she asked me if I would come in and help facilitate.
You're going to get phone calls. People are going to want you to
this
come.
This is why I'm trying to put that out right now.
Because you've got all the time in the world, right?
Right. Sure I do. But I want to tell you that I agreed to do it because I trust Joanne.
Yeah.
And I trust WXXI that it would not turn into something else. So it was easier for me to actually come in and do that. And I did share that experience at Table 23, and we talked about it a great deal. Right. So it was good. It's hard work. We just talked about hard work, and so.
How do you define hard work, Jackie?
That which we're passionate about, but actually moves us to do something different. So it's not about just because I care about it, but I'm in it because I see myself as a catalyst, and I want to engage other people who want to be on that journey. And so that's what I call hard work.
So I want to ask all three of you then, you know, what you have, you know, maybe gained, or at least what has come out in these 6 years of Table 23, before we kind of get into some of the questions that you were asking us to kind of probe into here at WXXI. What has it meant to you, Jackie? Table 23.
So, I'm taking off my glasses. That's what that pause was about. I am, and I say this a lot. I see myself as a catalyst, so I want to participate in this, one, because I want to understand better, but I also want to help others understand my own particular journey. So I can only speak about what my experiences have been and how those things have impacted me, and really just being ready to participate in those conversations. This is unusual. We don't have these these discussions that around race with diverse people. We have them. I don't want to speak for white folks. I can tell you, black people, we have these conversations all the time, but most of us come out and work in white spaces, so we see ourselves. Let me not say we. I see myself as somewhat of an expert. Like, I can tell you a lot about white people, but I think that there's probably little that white people can say specifically about people of color, and particularly black people, without referring to a stereotype, right? So I see myself as participating in that. It's meant a lot to me.
Okay. Alan, what has it meant to you?
I just want to go back to one thing, Evan, to correct the launch. What actually happened at the end of the day when we said, as Jackie has described, we want to keep talking, Heidi said, why don't we do a book club? And we said, wow, that's a neat idea. That'll give us some meat. And so a significant part of our early work together was reading books. And I think we read 5 or 6 of them. Mm-hmm. And then we got so engaged with each other that we just began talking about issues. We've seen some movies. We've seen some videos. And recently we've gone back to reading a book. Mm-hmm. And we're now trying to read From the Beginning by Ibram Kendi, mm-hmm. which is a story of, it says, black people in America, but in fact it starts in Europe and Africa. It's a wonderfully historical journey. Anyway, that's the background.
Okay, sure.
So I would say 2 significant things have happened to me. First of all, I've been educated. I'm clearly a person of privilege. I grew up in an upper middle class home, Brighton High School, went to an Ivy League college. I had it all. What I've learned, one of the things I've learned, is I'm a person of white privilege, which is different than just pure privilege. And that's been very helpful because that's helped me understand myself and my role in this journey. And the second thing that's happened is we've created relationships, and as Jackie has described, that has led us to candid, intimate conversations with each other in a way that just never happens. And Jackie says that the black folks talk a lot about race. White people don't. In fact, there's
have
a statement.
Have the advantage of not having to. It's part of advantage, I would think.
Why are white people, Frank Starpoli recently wrote an article, why are white people scared to talk about race? And you get us in a group, I'm generalizing, of course, and we're scared that we'll say something that will make Jackie angry or be the wrong thing to say. So we're all nervous. We don't have that in our group. And one of the real breakthroughs, we used to meet in each other's homes. Now we're doing some meeting in restaurants just because we all have different tastes and so on. But a real breakthrough for me, Jackie, was the day you decided that you would host us. Mm-hmm. And I remember your mm-hmm. comment. You said, I don't trust everybody to come into my home. Mm-hmm. And that was a breakthrough for all of us.
It was.
Because I didn't understand that. I don't have that feeling. Mm-hmm. So that's another piece of learning. So I've learned just a ton about the life of a black person. And it's given me enormous empathy and interest and intensity about what role can I play.
Is it hard at times? I mean, what have you, you're nodding over there. What's been the hardest part, Alan?
I think a couple times I've been called out for a remark that was, I guess I'd say racist, which was unintended. But I learned from that it's not what I say, it's what you hear. And that made me much more sensitive to how my language is, because I know in my heart what I felt. And one night when my wife made a remark that she was called out on, and I knew what she meant and what her heart was, but I was taught that, you know, it's not just what you say, it's what I hear. And that was very meaningful to me.
Okay.
I guess the other thing I would say is my antenna about this issue have just grown by leaps and bounds. I am so conscious of this issue all the time, which I'm thrilled about because it helps me play hopefully a bigger role with my center of influence. That has been really powerful.
Okay. Heidi, what has it meant for you?
I think one of the things that defined our group from the very beginning is that something about our personalities clicked from the beginning, and we had an intense interest in what was going on in each other's lives from the standpoint of race, and that we started by agreeing to meet in each other's homes. And that evolved, as Alan described. But it creates a kind of intimacy that you don't get any other way. And we've had a fairly consistent group. There's been a little movement in and out for a variety of reasons, but we have a core group that's ended up creating a very safe space to talk about these things. So I would say there are a couple of key things for me as a white person that have made me grow in ways that I think are very important. One is this whole concept of white privilege, and I agree with Alan, and I would say the same thing about my background. I feel privileged. But white privilege is a very different kind of thing, and being constantly aware of that has changed the way I view literally everything. So, and my place in the world and the place of everyone else has been very heavily impacted by that. And there are a whole series of things that we've talked about over the years that have grown my understanding of what life is like for people of color. And, you know, and I'll never really know because, as it was a quote in a movie I just saw the other day, if you're white, you can take a night off thinking about race. If you're black, you don't get a night off. So there's a constancy to what you deal with that I think is something that a lot of whites don't get. I also think that the way I think about it now is that the real work that needs to be done is primarily with whites because that's where the center of power and control remains in this country and, frankly, in Rochester. And so there's a lot that has to happen, not only to change your awareness as a white person of everything around you and of your impact on people, and language is very, very important, but also what do you do if you run an organization like I do or you're involved in community efforts, whatever they are? What you have a responsibility as a white person to constantly redefine who sits at tables, what issues are important, how diverse the voices are. And to be very blunt, I think that in order to really survive and survive well as a community in the 21st century, it's all about diverse voices. And if we can't, as whites, figure out how to open that door and let the new ideas and different people and different voices come into the room, we're gonna fail as a community. I mean, this isn't just even about the human experience, which is enough, by the way. It's also about what kind of a place you want to be. How does this impact economic policies and decisions you make in a region? Who sits on boards of directors? How do you make sure that everybody has a voice in where this community is moving? And you don't even realize how little that's true until you start having the kind of conversations we have, and then you start seeing it everywhere. And so for me, it's been a radical, eye-opening transformation. And I think one that's changed how I feel even as a woman, the experience of a black woman versus a white woman. There's so many layers to this that it really opened my eyes and changed things. And the fact that we've developed, in my view, a friendship, a depth to our relationships in this group, and it hasn't been without conflict and, you know, scary moments, frankly. But that's a good thing. And I think it's brought us together as a group in a way that's created a very different kind of bond. And I think that's really incredible. And I don't think it could have happened in a more institutional setting. I think it had to be very personal from the outset.
I want to ask Jackie Campbell to let us know, let our listeners know about one of the things you asked us to do here at WXXI, which is among the many, which is you asked us all to think about a question. And that question, if I'm remembering framing it right, was about the first time we really sort of understood or encountered racism. Mm-hmm. When that was. So take me through why you wanted an audience of people, majority white, but people from a lot of different backgrounds, to sit and think with that question for a moment and then have a conversation with the person next to them, which is what you asked us to do at WXXI. Why that particular question?
I think the question for different people will have a different response. And what happens for people of color and also specifically for black people is that when we ask a group to think about when they've heard about race, the onus typically falls on people of color. Because one of the myths that holds up supremacy and privilege is this the myth of white racelessness. So if you are not deliberately asked to think about it, then you think when you hear about race, you think about the other. So people of color typically have already thought and processed this, but white people have not. And one of the things that happened in the space is that we ask people to think about it and to talk about it and then to share. But the people who were sharing were only people of color. So then you ask white people, what is the response or why they're not speaking? And it comes down to what Alan said. It's sort of like, well, I don't want to say the wrong thing. But also that many times when they learn about the way that they experience or have talked about experiencing racism has to do with people who are in their group. But in order to disclose it, you have to disclose something about a family member or disclose something about someone who is close to you. And so I mentioned that we have the conversation about white people all the time. You know, I go home like, this happened to me today. Let me share this. And so we are prepared to talk about it, but other groups are not. But when you're trying to address issues around race and racism, that you have to make other people talk about it, or else there's no conversation.
White racelessness is such an pervasive idea, and I think it's hard to understand it unless you're intentional about trying to see it. And one of my favorite podcasts is John McWhorter, who is an African-American professor of linguistics and author. And his podcast is outstanding, by the way. But he recently was saying that it's this idea that a lot of white people think, well, I speak correctly the way mm-hmm. I speak. Our speech patterns, the language, the grammar we use is the standard. Mm-hmm. And everything else is a deviation from the standard. And wouldn't it be good if we could teach everyone to use the standard? When there is no correct, and he said, this is hard for people to understand. There's not a correct way to speak. And your way of speaking is not the standard of which we will try to drag everyone else mm-hmm. into. And I thought, boy, that's going to be hard for a lot of people to hear.
Absolutely.
But now hearing you use the term racelessness or white racelessness, mm-hmm. I think there's probably something that is connected there. This idea that, I don't speak with an accent.
Right.
I don't. I speak correctly.
Correct.
It's just an idea that it's the standard.
Mm-hmm.
From which everything else flows.
Right.
As opposed to, why are we centering this when mm-hmm. there's lots of different ways? So that's just one thing that
Absolutely.
Came to mind for me.
And you can expand on that to point to appearance, right? So what is the norm? And everything else that is not the norm then becomes not just other, but less than. So when you lift up white racelessness, and the first time I encountered this, or realize what I was encountering happened years ago, and I think I shared this at Table 23, in a class that I was in, and there was some racial issue that was happening in Rochester, like there always is. Mm. And the professor at the time said, oh, let's do an exercise. Let's write out all of the names that are offensive to black people. It was a class of about like maybe 35, and there were about like 7 or 8 of us, and you know, we filled up one chalkboard. This is when there was chalk and no, whatever it is now, but filled up one board and went to the next. And then there was, okay, now, so let's write down all the words that are offensive to white people. And so, you know, we went in. We started saying a whole bunch of things. And the white people who were the majority, and they were saying, nope, that's not, no, that doesn't bother me. Nope, that nope. And what bothered the white people in the room was whenever we put white in front of whatever it was we were saying. So if we said white boy or white something, then it became a problem because the socialization process does not lift up white people as having a color, right? So the white is the norm and everything else is not something other but a deviation of that.
Yeah, here's John Mehta writing for popularresistance.org on this idea. He writes, the reality of America is that white people are supposed to be fundamentally good. And so when a white person commits a crime, it is a sign that they, as an individual, exactly. are bad. Right. Their actions as a person are not indicative of any broader social construct. Even the fact that America has a growing number of violent hate groups populated mostly by white men, and that nearly all serial killers are white men, cannot shadow the fundamental truth of white male goodness. In fact, we like white serial killers so much, we make miniseries about them. Mm. White people are good as a whole and only act badly as individuals. And Mehta writes, people of color, especially black people, but boy, can we talk about the Mexicans in our country lately, are seen as fundamentally bad and maybe individually
Absolutely.
Good.
Wow.
Powerful.
Very powerful.
That's from an essay by John Mehta, which we can share with you if you're interested on our various platforms. Listeners, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I do, Evan. I wanted to pick up a little something on what Heidi said about this is a white problem. The first thing that I learned was, the most powerful thing I learned was from the New Jim Crow book, which is just loaded with factual evidence of stuff I had no idea about. And I considered myself someone who was sympathetic, someone who wanted to work on the racism issue, but I just did not have a clue. And that made me realize that, as Heidi has said, this problem has to be solved by white people. And one of the problems is that no white person's a racist. Are you a racist? No, I'm not a racist. But what's happened is the systemic racism and institutional racism, which has been formulated by white people, is what the problem is. And I had no clue about that. So that was a real aha for me. And it led me to work with a young black woman who you know, Eileen Graham, putting together a program which we call Race for Tomorrow, which is a program on really education about racial equality. And the target market we're trying to look at is suburban churches. My feeling being they're heavily white and mostly people of goodwill and good intent, but clueless. And I want to make them clued. and we've got some, we're going to do a big program at Mountain Rise Church in early March. We've done something for the Episcopal Diocesan Convention. Of all places, we did something for the Harvard Business Club. So that's my approach. I think that's the group that needs to hear these issues.
So, but let me also kind of take what Alan is saying and offer just sort of an idea for our panel to discuss here, which is that I don't have a lot of skills in my life. There's not a lot I do well. I do 500 hours of live radio a year, so I really try to observe how minds open and how minds change. My own mind and others. I find it thrilling when my mind changes on a subject. I think that's a powerful thing to happen. I'm not a big fan of obstinance. I like defending your ideas, but I also like being open to others. And, you know, so Alan is reaching a point in your life where maybe younger adults would call you woke, maybe. I don't know. Are you woke? Is that? I don't know if you're woke. I don't know.
I'd love to be woke.
Okay. I don't
that's accurate.
I don't even know if that's a pejorative now. But regardless, you know, there are people who come to different points in their life through different things. You know, Jackie, among others, has helped to open doors for you to think, to challenge yourself. You've had to be open to it.
Yep.
But you've noticed change. And when you talk about going out to a church that you see as kind of clueless, you know, or maybe not woke. The trouble I see sometimes, and not you, Alan, personally, is that sometimes people who have these epiphanies at various points, maybe they're 25 years old, maybe they're 75 years old or anything, they start assuming that everybody else needs to be exactly where they are immediately. Mm-hmm. And if they're not, they're bad. And I agree that there's a lot of bad in this world. But what I'm not necessarily comfortable with is this idea that we lose this self-awareness. I'm learning every day. I try to be really open to the advantage I have, what that means, who doesn't have advantage, who has disadvantage. And I try to be, you know, sort of open-minded when people disagree. I guess what I'm trying to say is we've got to have standards, but I don't want to shut out people who aren't as, you know, sort of agreeing on where we are. Does it make sense?
It does, and that's, I wouldn't have articulated it as well as you did, Evan, which, by the way, is one of the things you're good at.
I don't know about that.
But the program, I would call it very light. We use pollers so people can answer questions anonymously. We first go through some demographic work and then some questions about racism. How many of these black movies have you seen? A few other things. Then we come to some quotes. Howard Schultz, former president of Starbucks, who has put a big issue out, you may have seen mm-hmm. 5 or 6 years ago, about a 10-page insert in USA Today. Martin Luther King. Of all people, Benjamin Franklin, who I wouldn't have thought back in those days made something. Just to inform people. And then we really close with who would like to take some action? Who would like more information? We have a bibliography of things to do. So it's a very light approach and an approach that I think allows people to be private. We're not asking anybody if they're racist. We're not asking for raising of hands or any of those kinds of things. But we ask questions like, when was the last, how many times a year do you have a person of color in your home for dinner? How many times a year do you go to their home for dinner? And questions like that. Just to, I hope, raise awareness that, you know, gee, maybe I do have a little racial bias. Maybe I ought to look at that without trying to be pejorative. So I'm,
or trying to shame, maybe?
No interest in that at all.
Yeah, I want to ask other guests about this. I mean, Jackie, I was reading Dr. Marvin McMickle was recently writing about the difference between shaming and persuasion. And he is, in various platforms, calling for more of an effort to persuade, less of an effort to shame. And mm-hmm. Pastor McMickle, if you're listening, I would love to bring you back to Connections to talk about that very soon, because I found myself really just really listening to when mm-hmm. he's talking. How do you see the difference between persuasion and shaming, particularly when it probably, I mean, I certainly don't want to speak for anybody, but it must be frustrating at times to see how not advanced some folks' thinking is.
I absolutely can agree with the persuasion perspective. And to be honest, as an individual, I always have to sit with and reflect on my own behavior, what I'm thinking at any particular moment, and how that informs the actions that I take. I'm expecting that that's what happens for individuals. So I approach this from the perspective that people want to know. But I am very surprised at how little people do know. So I always stay armed with some information that people can just read. But I will tell you, I am well-read on this. And I have lived experience that informs that. It is frustrating to have conversations with people who don't read at all. And are trying to convince, because first of all, it's not an argument that they can win. But I also approach this as that individuals are really trying to know better and do better. Some people are not, and I don't have time for folks who are not. But if people are really interested in knowing what is going on and how can yeah. I contribute to making it better, there's tons. We can have a really good conversation. And persuasion works. It would be really good if we can persuade all the people who are in that group, because I think that's the larger group, and that then everybody can convince those other ones that they're that something's wrong. You need to go do something else.
Yeah, so it sounds to me like you're making sort of a judgment on, is this person coming with a good faith position with an open mind, and is this person not? If this person is not, I don't have time for that. But no matter where you are, if you're coming with a good faith idea.
And I'm assuming everybody's coming with a good faith idea until they show me different.
Yeah, yeah, I take that point.
I would add a couple things. One is that one of the most powerful experiences for me in this whole Table 23 the group that we started was the very first book we read, which still remains the most one of the most powerful things I've ever read. And it was called The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. And the reason it kind of blew me away is that we've all been through school in this country, all of us. We're all educated, at least mostly to the high school level and some beyond. Never in any educational setting in my entire life did I ever hear one word about the Great Black Migration, which involved millions of people and changed the face of cities and populations and so many things. And yet we never heard one word about it. And reading this book, you're kind of going, how could we have gone through a supposedly decent education and not understand such an absolutely gigantic change in American life? And the answer is because it depends on who's doing the telling. And so you start, it starts a whole cascade of thoughts about everything. And Alan had mentioned earlier about this whole burgeoning community discussion about structural racism and what's embedded in our systems, in our institutions, in our companies, and that it, just in the way we relate. And so for me, my, you know, Alan talked has talked about some of the things he's done in a positive way to turn his own personal transformation around and give something back to the community. And in my experience, it's been to start getting at the structural racism issue any way I can. And for me, I start with the organization I run. Its board of directors, its activities, who the voices are around that table. And because it's a much more diverse set of voices now, we have very different kinds of discussions, and it influences the priorities of what we do in the space that we operate in. And also in my work with the Community Foundation, it's had everything to do with how the whole grant-making framework was completely reconfigured, and there were many others involved in that process, in the start of the mission-related investing work that we're doing now. All of these things start in large measure with questions about institutional and structural racism and about how you start leveling the playing field for people. And you give good people with a desire to give back to the community a chance to do that. And so it's part of a personal transformation as well as what do you do with it? And that's a constant conversation we have at Table 23 is, should we be out marching? Should we be writing speaking out letters? Should we, you know, how do we've become activated as in many ways, personally as well as a group. So how do you start? It's one thing to talk and to deal with our own internal stuff, but how do you turn that around and actually impact the community you're living in? So all these things kind of roil around in our discussions in a good way, and that's kind of how I'm dealing with it.
I've got some emails from listeners. They've got questions that they would love our panel to help them with. We're going to get those emails in, and we'll get some more of your feedback as we talk about this group, Table 23. This is an informal group that came together about 6 years ago, and they have conversations that are tough, direct, important about race in various parts of our society. You just heard Heidi Zimmermeyer, president of the Rochester Downtown Development Corporation, and Alan Ziegler, the founder and president of the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation, Jackie Campbell, director of Rock the Future at the Children's Agenda. Let's get that only break, and we'll get those emails in next. Coming up in our second hour, here's the CNN headline from this morning, casting Bryan Cranston as someone with quadriplegia. Hollywood could do better. Bryan Cranston, known for his work in Breaking Bad, says he's just taking on this role and the studio is making a business decision. But it sets a broader discussion in motion about unemployment for people with disabilities, and we'll have that conversation next hour. Welcome back to Connections. On Twitter, Tom says, this is one of the most important radio programs I have ever heard. Thank you. Well, thank you, Tom. I appreciate that. And our guests here, they did not have to speak publicly about Table 23. In fact, they were saying during the break, that's not the intention of the group. They didn't come together to sort of lecture to the public. It was just it's an ongoing thing. So we're glad that they trust Connections with this conversation. Let me read Rebecca's email. Rebecca and Chile sends the following. She writes, I'm wondering how to address the issue of race with my son, who is 6, and my daughter, who is 2. We are white people, and my son still doesn't really seem to notice race that much. We've talked about how people have all different colors to their skin, and we have books where the main characters are not white, but it's not the point of the book, like The New Small Person or The Snowy Day. And I don't know what is the best way to approach this subject. How to explain to him that when he's 18 and gets pulled over by a police officer, he does not have to fear for his life, while his cousin Andrew, who is black, would. Or that a soccer coach might be discriminating against the black player, as one of my friends described to me regarding her son. He has interactions with people of color, but doesn't seem to identify them as particularly different. We talk in general about how different isn't bad. Different is just different. So we all look different, but one way isn't better or worse than another. But I feel like I should be educating both of my children specifically about race somehow, just not sure what to do, and any suggestions would be appreciated. It's from Rebecca and Charlie. Jackie?
Wow. So I just want to say that as the black person, I was saying to myself, I don't know if I'm the person to really ask this. The reason is because as a black parent, I socialize my children to expect racism and discrimination. Because as a parent, to not arm them so that they can defend themselves would be criminal and for me. But I sympathize with parents who are actually having to deal with that, because there is the truth, and then there is what you know, all of the other issues that exist. And so I would really like for Heidi or Alan to sort of jump in here.
I've been through this. We have three children, and our decision was a little bit different in that we chose to live in the city and send our kids to city schools. So they walked into, literally on day one, even preschool, in very mixed racial environments. And so from day one, and we watched, you know, one of my daughters came home and said, I have a new friend, and she has very dark hair. And she kept talking about this one friend again and again. And finally, when I went to pick up, I said, show me who your friend is. She was very, very dark-skinned black child. But my daughter didn't even see it. So I understand that mother is saying her kids don't even really notice. And I found that with all three of my kids. But I think this particular parent is halfway there. And I think if you're living in a suburban location, which a lot of folks do for a variety of reasons, and you don't have the experience my children did, I think books, I think having dinner table conversations that are straightforward and honest when you're out in public and things happen, if you ever catch your child saying or thinking, expressing an opinion that starts to cross over, call them on it, have it be a teachable moment. Build compassion about people and their lives and differences, what people go through. Because I think it's more than just saying, oh, that person has black skin, they're just like you. I didn't even think that's the right message, because they're a human being like you, but their experiences are very different. And what you want is you want kids that recognize that everything isn't the same. Because I think that's a lie, to be honest with you. I think that if I'm being honest, what you want from your children is to recognize that not everybody has it as good as they do. If you're white and you get white privilege by birth, you've got to build into your kids a recognition that this is an unjust circumstance, and that you want to build into your kids, they're going to be future leaders of something, somewhere, and certainly parents probably. You want them to think about the world and see the world in a much more blended way than they would have ordinarily. So I think books, I think very open and plain conversations, any kind of, you get kids involved in soccer leagues or baseball leagues, make an effort to try and find ways for your kids to be involved in things that do involve kids that aren't just like them. And so that they can begin in a very natural, social way to interact with kids who are not born the same. And so, you know, otherwise, I don't know how you do it. But I think having the open conversations, by the way, that's true for adults too, you can't deal with the issue of race without very frank and open conversations, and that's very hard. But as a parent, you can initiate that in your own home.
Rebecca, my son's roughly the same age as your oldest child. There is not a perfect formula when society is structured the way it is to create advantage and disadvantage. And I'm sure I make missteps all the time. But I think Heidi's making really important points. One of my perspectives is be really intentional about interacting and having your circle of friends and people around you. Be, you know, people from a lot of different backgrounds. And I know some of our listeners are going to hear what Heidi's saying and say, boy, you're loading up your kid with a lot of guilt. Or, you know, that's one of the things I do hear white parents kind of pull back from. But I also hear, we had a guest, I'm just representing what I hear a lot. Not that I necessarily agree, but I understand the sentiment because we had a conversation about language with another professor who had written a book, an African-American professor who was here on the program, brought his daughter who was off school that day. And I think she was 4. And he said to me afterwards, he said, I don't have a choice. You know, I've got a black child. We talk about race. We don't get that choice. Like, and he said, white parents, you have a choice. You don't have to talk about it if you don't want to, because the world centers you. And but I don't have that choice. And that stayed with me. So I thought, I'm not going to make that choice not to talk about it. And I'm doing it in a way that's loving but direct. And I think kids can handle it more than we often think. What do you think?
And I don't think it's an issue of guilt as much as it is building compassion, awareness,
sure,
and perspective into your kids. I don't think my kids have a sense of guilt. It's more a sense of understanding the realities of the world in a way that helps them to negotiate it and become the kinds of community people mm-hmm. that personally I want them to be.
Can I ask you a blunt question since we're doing
sure.
blunt conversation?
Mm-hmm.
Would you, if you sort of were raising young children again now after everything that you've done with Table 23, do you think you'd approach these conversations differently than you did when your kids were younger?
Yes, although I was pretty candid.
Okay.
I remember one time I said to my kids, we had 4 living at home, at Christmas time, I said, you know, our Christmases are so lavish and there are so many people that have so little. Let's invite someone who in poverty to have Christmas Day and dinner with us. And my second son, who's got quite a wicked sense of humor, recently he lives in Los Angeles and he's been cooking Thanksgiving dinner and taking out to the street people. And he said, Dad, he said, that was planted that year you said invite a bum, which was his description of that. So we did some of it early. I would be much more intentional now. But 2 things that I just want to jump on. One, the race exhibit, which, by the way, was what started Free, that the museum had. A huge learning for me was there's only one race. And I think that's something I would talk to my kids about. And, you know, in Africa, you were black. In Italy, you were olive. In France, you were something else. And when you got to Norway, you were white as snow. That was a real important learning for me. Now, unfortunately, using the word race gives us a tool to talk about the problem. So not sure that's helpful. The other thing that one of the early learnings, Jackie, was at that first Table 23 discussion, and each table was given a question to talk about. That's what launched our conversation. And I'm pretty sure the question was, racism means to me, fill in the blanks. And Jackie said, means I have to be 2 different people. Mm-hmm. I'm one person at work, and I'm different at home in my neighborhood.
Code switching.
And I went, whoa, really?
Mm-hmm.
And I've now realized, what a burden, because I'm a huge believer in authenticity. You can't be authentic. That's a pressure that I've never had.
Or you have to construct different authentic selves in different spaces.
Anyway, that was a real eye-opener to me, and that helped a lot with my empathy for the issue now.
You want to add to that part?
Well, I was speaking, and I remember that in a very general way, because I am a person who tries to be authentic in the same wherever I go. But I do recognize that what is expected of me in one space is very different. And so we even talked about this in terms of having dinner at each other's homes. Like, it took me a long time. Like, we were just bouncing around from a couple of places. And I finally said, okay, I think I want to have them come into my home, which is my sanctuary. But it's, if you walk into my home, you know that you're in a black person's home, like statues, pictures, everything. And I build it so that I can affirm myself when I walk in the door, because I know that in other spaces that I am in, I might not see me. So really having an understanding of who you are and what you bring to different spaces is what I believe people of color, and particularly black people, really have to understand better than other groups, because we do believe we are held up in any issue that happens. Like, we are the representative for the whole race. So we have to be that when we are out in the community.
Let me read a little bit more feedback. Eugenia Marlene writes to us and say, Evan, this is one of the most honest and edifying conversations about race issues and some approaches to that we might take to help us have larger conversations that we need to have. Excellent guests. Thank you, Eugenia. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, just something that I lost sight of.
Oh, yeah.
I want to get back to Rebecca.
Oh, yes, yes.
One of the things I would suggest is that you do your very best, and Evan touched on this, to socialize with the black families. Invite the little girls and her parents over for dinner. See if you can't get that reciprocated, which is, as Jackie has instructed us, maybe a little more difficult. But it's only when you can really create a relationship that you're going to, number one, understand, and number two, have the empathy for the world they have to live in. You talked about educating children, and Jackie had daughters, but what I've learned is the talk.
Mm-hmm. The talk.
Have you
had a huge
the
impact.
Talk with
right.
your son about how to act when he gets pulled over at 18 mm-hmm. when he hasn't done anything? Those are really important lessons. Speaking as a white person, that's really illuminating about the life of a black person that I have no understanding of. And it's those kinds of things, I think, that allow you to create empathic relationships with others that will lead you to educate your child.
If I just wanted to add just one point, because I'm remembering the conversation that we were having downstairs and when we were having that a few months ago. And the other mothers in particular were also having this conversation with sons as well. And so there were several folks who were raising biracial sons and also having to deal with that, even though they had not had that experience, knew that that was the reality for their children. So
let me get back to some of your feedback. Nick in Fairport says, I agree with other listeners' tweet. This is the most important show I have heard on Connections. This panel is inspiring, also sobering, honest, and a little intimidating, but most importantly, inspiring. That is from Nick. Robert writes to us and say, white person here, one of the biggest hurdles for discussing race with white people is that white people don't want to be labeled as a racist. So they go on and on about how they're not racist. They've got black friends, they support Kaepernick, etc. And the discussion never really goes anywhere. He says, I hate this term, but people need to stop being snowflakes and be willing to have tough discussions that will be uncomfortable and, more importantly, force you to look in the mirror and admit your faults. That's from Robert. Do you agree with that, Jackie?
Absolutely.
One of my favorite expressions, Evan, is in a conversation, no, there was a guy, black guy on my basketball team. I'm good.
Mm-hmm, right.
Or, no, my hairdresser's gay. I'm good. No.
Right.
Go ahead.
And it's also the other thing that we've talked a lot about, both in our group and outside of our group, is this illusion that because Barack Obama was elected president, we're now in a post-racial society.
Well, that got blown away.
Yeah, we got to just, that kind of thinking has got to be blown out of the water, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the reasons why we have dinner in each other's homes, because we like to socialize over food. Like, that's sort of like a very common element. And we have really lavish desserts, by the way.
Excellent.
But
thank you, Leonard.
It allows us to sort of let down our guard and have open conversations. But you, I would say that, and I believed, and I still believe to some degree, that I have less to learn about this because I live it. But I've learned a lot about participating, about being willing to be heard, and you can even see, like, even when we're giving feedback, you can see the mind working, like, well, wait a minute, let me sit with that for a minute. Mm-hmm. I think that this is, if we are going to address racism at all, and I don't think that we have a choice in this day and age, if we are going to address it at all, we need to begin with having real open and honest and transparent conversations, because individuals are really in charge of institutions and lifting up and holding up systemic racism. It's got to begin with individuals.
And I put a code on that. You're putting a big thumbs up.
Yeah, big thumbs up on that. Absolutely right.
I want to thank our guests here. We already have our listeners saying, you should do Table 23 on Connections every month. I don't know if they want to do that. but you may. This is an open invitation to bring your table back to Connections whenever you like, because these conversations go on. And I really want to thank Jackie Campbell. Thank you for taking the time to help lead this conversation. I really appreciate it. Appreciate what you do.
Thanks
you very much.
Us.
Alan Ziegler, Heidi Zimmermeyer, thank you. Thank you for being here. Short break, more Connections coming up.